over to you, Dr. Tedros, for your opening remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, Fadila. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. First, to a conflict that has been dragging on for many months, with tens of thousands killed, millions displaced, and health services severely disrupted. I'm not talking about Gaza. I'm talking about Sudan. The war the world had either forgotten or ignored. Sudan is the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with 12 million people displaced, 10 million internally, while 2 million have fled to neighboring countries. More than 70% of hospitals in conflict-affected states and 45% of health facilities in another five states are not working. And the remaining ones are overwhelmed with people seeking care. People are dying from a lack of access to essential services and medicines, while there is a very real risk of mass starvation in some regions. Critical services, including maternal and child health care, the management of severe acute malnutrition, and the treatment of patients with chronic conditions have been discontinued in many areas. Disruptions to telecommunications are affecting disease surveillance and reporting, as well as our ability to verify attacks on health. We call for a swift restoration of telecommunication access across all of Sudan. As the situation in Sudan continues to decline, WHO is on the ground supporting life-saving interventions and outbreak response. We provide expert advice, training, and oversight to health operations, management of malnutrition, disease surveillance, and outbreak response. WHO also continues to distribute urgently needed medicines, medical supplies using all available avenues, including cross-border and cross-line operations to reach previously unreachable areas in Darfur and Kordofan, where the needs are greatest. With breakthrough deliveries, some areas that had not been reached this year have been reached. However, insecurity and operational hurdles continue to pose a challenge in the timely delivery of supplies and services. We ask you, the world's media, to continue drawing attention to Sudan and not to allow our world to forget it. Now to Gaza. WHO welcomes the UN Security Council resolution adopted on Monday, which calls for a full and immediate ceasefire, the unconditional release of all hostages, a permanent end to hostilities, and the reconstruction of Gaza. We urge all parties to take steps to implement the resolution immediately and bring a permanent end to the suffering of millions of people. We also welcome this week's conference in Amman, Jordan, which aims to intensify humanitarian aid for Gaza. A significant proportion of Gaza's population is now facing catastrophic hunger and famine-like conditions. Despite reports of increased delivery of food, there is currently no evidence that those who need it most are receiving sufficient quantity and quality of food. WHO and our partners have scaled up nutrition services. Over 8,000 children under 5 years old have been diagnosed and treated for acute malnutrition, including 1,600 children with severe acute malnutrition. However, due to insecurity and lack of access, only 2 stabilization centers for severely malnourished patients can operate. Our inability to provide health services safely combined with the lack of clean water and sanitation, significantly increased the risks of malnourished children. There have already been 32 deaths attributed to malnutrition, including 28 among children under 5 years old. While the world's focus has been on Gaza, there is also an escalating health crisis in the West Bank, where attacks on healthcare and restrictions on movement of people are obstructing access to health services. Since the war in Gaza started, 508 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, including 124 children. More than 5,000 have been injured, including about 800 children. WHO has documented 480 attacks on healthcare in the West Bank since the 7th of October last year, resulting in 16 deaths and 95 injuries. In most areas of the West Bank, clinics are only operating 2 days a week, and hospitals are operating at about 70% capacity. Illegal settlements have expanded in the occupied West Bank, impacting the population's access to health services. WHO is supporting the Ministry of Health through buying essential medicines and providing technical assistance on policies and procedures. We have also prepositioned supplies at key hospitals across the West Bank, including in East Jerusalem, and conducted trauma management training for first aid responders in affected communities. In the West Bank, as in Gaza, the only solution is peace. Once again, we urge all sides to implement the Security Council resolution immediately. Again, the best medicine is peace. Now to the United States and the outbreak of H5N1 avian influenza among dairy cattle. Since our last update 5 weeks ago, the number of affected dairy herds has almost tripled to 92 in 12 states. The number of human cases has increased from 1 to 3, and the number of people being monitored has more than doubled to 500. Since 2003, there have been 893 reported infections of H5N1 in humans, including 11 so far this year, 5 in Cambodia, 3 in the US, and 1 each in Australia, China, and Vietnam. In that time, the virus has not shown signs of having acquired the ability to spread easily among humans. That remains the case, which is why, at this time, WHO continues to assess the risk to public health as low. In recent years, H5N1 has spread widely among wild birds, poultry, land, and marine mammals on several continents. WHO recommends that anyone working with any infected animals in any country should have access to and use personal protective equipment. Follow-up testing and care of people exposed to the virus should continue systematically. Early medical care and support and thorough and timely investigation of every human infection is essential to evaluate and interrupt potential onward transmission between humans. WHO is monitoring multiple avian flu viruses in humans through the Global Influenza Surveillance and Response System. Surveillance of flu viruses among animals globally must also be intensified to rapidly detect any changes to the virus that could pose a greater threat to humans. These systems are only as good as the timely detection and the sharing of viruses and information. Collaboration, communication, and information sharing between animal and human health sectors is essential in all countries. This is the meaning of One Health. Finally, a brief word to a colleague who is well known to many of you in the media, Gregory Hartl. Greg joined WHO in 1997 and has been a key part of WHO's communications ever since, doing thousands of interviews and briefings with journalists and answering their questions. Many of you have interacted with Greg in one way or another. Today is Greg's last day with us. Greg, thank you for your service to WHO and for everything you have done to communicate the work of WHO to the world. You should know that we will miss you, but you will always be part of the WHO family. As we say, once WHO, always WHO. Thank you so much for your service and commitment. Thank you, Greg. And Fadila, back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Tedros. Thank you, Gregory. Now, I would like to open the floor to journalists' question, starting with Helen Branswell from STAT. Helen, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Fadila. Can I also extend my congratulations to Gregory on his retirement? I'm sorry that you're leaving WHO, but you've been such a huge help over the years. You know, I wish that you have a wonderful retirement. My question is about the H5N1 situation in the United States. Given what WHO knows about the situation at the moment, does it believe that the virus can be driven out of cows at this point, or does it seem like it may be, you know, in the process of becoming endemic in cows? And if it's believed that it can be driven out of cows, what additional steps need to be taken to achieve that end? Thank you.
Dr. Van Kerkhoff.
Yeah, thanks. And I know we have Wenjing Zhang online, who's the head of our global influenza program, so she may want to supplement. So the question is that you've specifically asked, Helen, relates to dairy cattle. And the USDA and other organizations within the U.S. are trying, as far as we understand, are trying to really better understand the circulation in this species, understanding first how the species was infected, likely, you know, the introduction through birds, but how the virus is circulating between herds, between animals, between herds. Right now, what we can say is that we've got 92 herds in 12 states that are infected. So before we can answer the question of can it be eliminated from this species, we really need to understand the extent of infection. And we do know that there are many partners that are working hard on this. You will have heard from the DG speech that we, as the World Health Organization and looking at public health risk, need to understand the exposure that humans have in relation to exposure in infected animals. So it's dairy cattle, but it's also wild birds, it's poultry, it's marine mammals, it's land mammals. And so for us, I'm broadening out your question a bit, but for us, what we really need is stronger surveillance in animal populations so that we can assess the risk to humans, but also to assess the risk of what's happening within the animals themselves. So we, through the Global Influenza Surveillance and Response System, have a strong system of looking at samples from humans. These are mainly avian viruses, but in fact, the GISRA system looks at all influenza viruses. But we also work with our partner agencies at FAO and WOHA through OFFLU that are looking at viruses directly coming from animals. So there's quite a bit of work that's out there. Fundamentally, these systems are only as strong as the information that's provided, the viruses that are shared, the timeliness of that, the sequences being shared, so that assessments can be made. So there's a lot more information that we need, I think, to fully be able to answer that question. But perhaps Wenjing wants to supplement.
So thanks very much, Helen, for this question. Along the line, what Maria said, I think it is too early to say that this virus can be eliminated or driven out of cattle. But I think if the virus has not established its power or capacity to transmit efficiently among cattle, certainly there is a possibility of stop the transmission itself. What we are expecting to see is that the number of herds and the number of states being affected could be reduced and eventually becoming zero. And with this, I do think there's a possibility that this virus can be eliminated from this particular species. As we had to see, like in the past, we did see the virus was detected in seals, etc. And we didn't see that it's being transmitted further of that.
Thank you. So it was Dr. Zheng Wenjing, Unit Head Global Influenza Program at WHO. Now I would like to invite Gabriel Emmanuel from NPR to ask the next question. Gabriel, you have the floor.
Hi, thank you. I also have a question about avian flu. I'm interested in, I guess, two different pieces. One is whether there are lessons that we can learn from how avian flu has been dealt with in poultry over the years that can be applied or need to be applied to the cattle industry, and also whether this is kind of a totally new era or phase we're in, as you've mentioned, just the range of animals that have avian flu is much broader than it was, say, a few decades ago. Thank you.
There's so many lessons that we have learned about avian influenza and its circulation. This virus has been circulating, influenza viruses have been circulating for decades, of course, but avian influenza, there are several different subtypes of avian influenza that are circulating that we're learning from, particularly with poultry. It's not just the domestic poultry, it's also the wild birds that we see. And a lot of what is needed relates to the biosecurity on farms, the trade of these animals, the way that they are raised, the way that they are sold. And many people around the world rely on backyard poultry, for example, for their livelihoods. So it needs to be done in a way that protects the animals themselves, protects the food supply, and protects human health. Again, you're asking a question that we rely on our support with our partner agencies of FAO, of WOHA, but also in country, the ministries of agriculture, the ministries of the environment, those that are responsible for the health and well-being and food safety in country. So this is the One Health approach in effect, making sure that we have strong collaborations with human health sectors, animal health sectors. Again, as the DG pointed out, the sharing of information, the communication between these sectors, as we've learned during the poultry outbreaks, which are still happening, by the way. I mean, the second part of your question of looking at the extent of this, this epizootic that we are seeing of avian influenza across the globe didn't just happen in recent months. This has been happening over the course of many years. And what we've seen is with the movement of wild birds and the flyaway patterns that they have, infection among the wild birds themselves into domestic poultry, and then spilling over into different species. The concern that I think we have is the geographic spread. The concern that we have is infecting new animal species. And of course, this puts more people exposed to that. And that's what we need to be able to rapidly assess, the viruses that are circulating, any changes in those viruses that are circulating, to make sure that the system that is in place can react as quickly as possible to make sure that we have the best advice that is out there, that should we need to produce vaccines, that we're in a good position to have the right viruses shared with across the laboratory systems and with manufacturers, so we could ramp up production when necessary. We're not in that situation yet. So there's a lot that we are learning, but specifically around the poultry and avian influenza, that work that's done at the most local level with communities using this One Health approach of animal health, the environmental sector, and human health, sharing information rapidly for that early detection. The earlier detection that we have, the stronger the biosecurity we have within the farms, the earlier that we can mitigate any potential spillover into human populations and potential onward spread.
Thank you so much, Maria. I believe Dr. Zheng would like to add something, and Dr. Ryan?
Yes, with regards to avian influenza outbreak in poultry, since it started in 1996 or 7 and re-emerged in 2002, 2005, many years passed. As Maria also mentioned, that first, we have an extremely good global system. That's a global influenza surveillance and the response system. It's mentioned in DG's opening speech as well. It means that we have the buy-in from countries, from member states in conducting the surveillance, the global surveillance system. The second is that through the pandemic preparedness and actually through the seasonal, every year we have seasonal epidemic. Basically, we've been exercising the pandemic preparedness. It's not a simulation or tabletop. It's real exercise. Through seasonal epidemic, we set up this vaccine response, vaccine virus update. We have this smooth collaboration or public-private collaboration to every year. It is repeated of that. The second part is about what's new. So cow is a new mammal, a species here. Actually, a lot of things are still yet to be developed. For example, cow certainly has very different distribution of the different receptors in different organs, and it is still being studied how this virus is being transmitted and to what level of efficiency among those cattle. If it's like a direct transmission itself. So this type of research is going on, and the implication of those to human, to public health, again, also still need to be looked into. So this is an emerging challenge, as you also mentioned in your question, that we are looked into. Back to you.
Dr. Ryan?
Just to follow up on the point that was made about what we've learned from surveillance and veterinary health controls in the poultry industry that might be applied in this particular situation. Because for years, people who work in the poultry and swine industry in particular have been very, very sensitive to the issue of influenza, because the arrival of avian flu into a flock of birds or into a swine population often results in heavy culling operations, and therefore preventing the disease moving from one flock or one herd to the other is hugely important. And you'll find in many countries there are huge biosecurity measures within plants or within farms, and then there are major biosecurity measures between, when animals move between farms or move between these different installations. What has to be remembered here, and I think this is very important, is that cattle are large animals and they're of huge individual economic value. They're worth huge amounts of money, and in many situations these are very large dairy farms and they're supporting a lot of livelihoods, supporting a lot of communities. So I'm sure in the US, for example, the US Department of Agriculture are trying to balance what is the risk of this disease against what is the economic hardship caused by restrictions of movement, increased costs of biosecurity. And this is something that industry has faced, certainly the swine industry, the poultry industry. And those industries need support. They need support from government. They need support in being able to implement those type of measures. Because ultimately, they're protecting the quality of food, they're protecting the quality of farm to fork, but also, in this particular case, protecting us, potentially, down the line from diseases of pandemic potential. So I think this is not a very straightforward issue. This is really where people talk about One Health, and there's a lot of talk about One Health, and it's a very nice thing to speak about, and it's lovely to speak about it in academic circles. But the reality here is many, many thousands of people rely on an industry for their livelihoods and income. Many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, rely on the food that's produced in those systems. But because of this virus moving around in species now, it's causing a major complication. And there really has to be very, very strong consultation between the agriculture industry and the health, and this is in every country, this is just happens to be the latest conversation in the United States, but this has been had all over the world. And this is what we mean by One Health: recognizing potential threats to humans on the animal side of the barrier and putting in place measures to protect that animal, that species barrier, so these viruses don't jump across. But that doesn't come for free. Unfortunately, that doesn't come for free. That requires real investment. Real investment in surveillance, real investment in policies on animal movement, real investment in being able to diagnose and contain quickly. And in the case where animals have to be culled, compensation programs. One of the biggest problems we see on the poultry side is the absence of compensation programs in many countries, where farmers often see their poultry culled with no compensation, which is a huge disincentive to support to reporting. So there are communities affected by this virus in the United States, not necessarily people being sick, but communities that are affected now by the economic impact of the restrictions of the movements. We will not find solutions at this one health animal-human species barrier until we have adequate consultation between agricultural and health sector, adequate compensation programs, intensive surveillance programs, and an attempt to support those industries to keep doing what they do, feed people, but do it safely. There are no straight lines there, and I don't want to overstate it, but sometimes everyone thinks, oh, all you have to do is stop the disease in the animals and then the disease will stop in humans. But that's not always straightforward. There are huge economic issues at play here, and this is where government need to step in and put in place the appropriate policies to make sure everyone's safe.
Thank you. I would like now to invite Belissa Godino from W Magazine to ask the next question. Belissa, you have the floor.
Thank you. The European Union has already announced provision vaccines to influenza, avian influenza. Are they effective at this point? You can comment on that. Thank you.
Dr. Zhang?
So first of all, I will try to confirm your question is related to European Union's action about stockpiling of H5N1 vaccines. Yes. I guess that's your question, right? Okay. So from WHO, actually in the past more than a dozen of years, twice a year, WHO we've been updating the candidate vaccine viruses for zoonotic influenza. And this is for including H5. The purpose of updating that candidate that vaccine viruses is for pandemic vaccine preparedness, i.e. in our recommendation, in the preamble, we always say that CVVs are being updated from the latest emerged viruses, make them available to the countries, to the manufacturers, so that for countries and manufacturers who wish to produce certain pilot lot and to conduct clinical trials as well as stockpile, they can do so. But as it is stated, is that we've been leaving this type of response to the national and regional authorities. But I think the situation now in the past 2 weeks is a little bit different because there are countries moving ahead with the physical stockpile. But just to point out, it is not new because the national's decision, regional's decision about stockpiling as a step of pandemic preparedness, it is not new. The question here is when to use that and at which condition it need to be used. So this is something we've been in frequent course or close contact with countries having such stockpile, and the countries and regions are still under discussion because a lot of considerations need to be taken with regards how to use this number, limited number or so of vaccines for which purposes is to protect the farmers from getting severe infections. And it could be if the current virus contained in the vaccines happens to be the virus causing the infection for now, yes, but in 1 month, in 2 months' time, it might be evolved away. And also in other parts of the globe, this is different clade of the H5 virus circulating. The current vaccines containing the current strain may not be the perfect to protect the infection of that population infected with other clade of viruses. or the purpose of the vaccination is for pandemic preparedness. For example, they vaccinate with this strain as prime booster schedule, and then to prepare for the next pandemic, for the next new strain eventually causing a pandemic, even if the strain is different from the current one, to match this prime booster schedule, this scheme. But all this would still need a lot of data, a lot of trials. For example, if at the moment it's H5, but if the pandemic is H7 or H9, how the vaccines can work out? So I do think the stockpile of the vaccine certainly is a very active step towards pandemic preparedness, but a lot of questions need to be addressed through discussion with authorities, but also a lot of research questions, regulatory questions need to be addressed in order to eventually use those vaccines in a systematic way. Back to you.
Thank you, Dr. Zhang. I believe Maria would like to compliment Dr. von Kerkhove. You have the floor.
Yeah, I do, because I think I want to broaden this out a bit, because what we are seeing and what we are doing as an organization is active preparedness and readiness. And this has started well before we started seeing infections in dairy cattle in the U.S. And there's a lot of attention to avian influenza right now. But this is something that we as an organization, our partner agencies, our member states have been actively tracking, monitoring, assessing, not sitting back and just idly watching this virus circulate around the globe. So active work in preparedness and readiness is something that we do on a daily basis. We are doing this not only internally, we are not only doing this within the GISRIS system with our partners, but we've learned a lot from COVID in the last 4 years. I do want to highlight one really important thing that we have mentioned before is that we have the PIP framework. This is, I'm going to read this because we have, it's an international instrument that has been negotiated by 194 member states. It came into effect in 2011. And this pandemic influenza preparedness, the PIP framework, as we call it, has three major activities. One is to make sure that all of the influenza viruses with pandemic potential are rapidly shared within the coordinated network that we have of influenza laboratories globally, so that they can conduct rapid and timely risk assessments. This is happening on a daily basis. This is happening, and this is why it's so important that surveillance is strong. I'm more concerned about having strong surveillance in many different species, across many different animal species and in humans, to better assess this virus and track this virus. Secondly, the PIP framework has been set up to ensure that WHO has the appropriate tools and funds to ensure access to products, especially for state parties or member states who don't have such access. And third, that we have a robust governance system. This is already in place, and this has been in place since 2011. But we did have the COVID pandemic in the meantime, and we've learned a lot from that. And so what we need to do is make sure that we use this framework, we use this governance system that we have. And Dr. Tedros and Mike Ryan and others have been negotiating or working with member states to support their negotiation on the pandemic accord. We have to ensure that we don't make the same mistakes that we did during COVID. We have to make sure that we have strong equity for the use of these medical products based on risk and need. But contextually for avian influenza, we have had limited numbers of human cases associated with the outbreak in dairy cattle in the U.S. We've had 3 human cases. You've heard that since 2003, we've had less than 900 human cases reported. Should the situation change, should we start to see human-to-human transmission, we have a system in place that can activate and increase production for pandemic influenza vaccines, but we're not quite there yet. So I did want to kind of broaden that out a little bit. While we do see active preparedness and readiness actions by our member states, this is a good thing, but we need to make sure that we focus on the fundamentals, that we have that strong surveillance, we have timely sharing of viruses, timely sharing of information, so those risk assessments can be done to make sure that the advice and the next steps are done in the right order and done at the right time.
Thank you so much. We have come to the end of our press conference. Thank you so much for your participation. We will be sending you the audio file and Dr. Tedros' opening remark just after this briefing. If you have any follow-up question, please don't hesitate to reach out to the WHO media team. Now, I would like to hand over to Dr. Tedros for his closing remarks. DG, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Fadila. And thank you to the members of the press for joining us today. And see you next time.